In my talk, I want to explore yet another level of meaning and readability of ritual texts and recitations and show how I'm working now in my example with these things. And I think maybe in the discussion there will be some interesting add-ups from all the talks we had before together with my inputs. It's the notions of ethnic identity and its geographical boundaries and reference points and how they are expressed in the oral traditions of the Dumi Rai of Eastern Nepal. The points I'm going to talk about are partly the outcomes of my field research in Eastern Nepal of the last 8 years, and they also form the base for a larger project I'm planning together with my wife starting by the end of next year, which aims at exploring all these topics in greater detail, hopefully with the support of the Austrian Research Foundation, where we handed in a grant application. Let's hope we will. We will get it. We will do it anyway. First of all, let me get you acquainted with the research area and the people I'm studying. The Dumi Rai, one of many small ethnic groups inhabiting the Himalayan foothills of eastern Nepal, south of the area of the Mewahang, we heard about in the first talk this morning. Together with their neighboring Rai, Limbu, Sunuvar, and Yaka, they form what is known as Kiranti or Kirat. And I have a map. Who knows eastern Nepal? It's south of Solukhumbu area. We see in between these two rivers on top, this is the main settlement area where we find the Dumi. The areas below are today also settled in by Dumis, but it's certainly not the place where they normally settled in. Here we have an overview of all Rai groups in the area. All these Kiranti groups speak languages of the Tibeto-Burman language family, which are usually subdivided into numerous local dialects. The same is it among the Dumi. We have at least three dialects within the Dumi language. And then again, we have these languages often supplemented by a ritual language, which is only used during specific rituals conducted by shamans or knowledgeable elders. The use of this Dumi language, in my case, is very much on the decrease. Probably, I guess, around at maximum 500 speakers are still left, and they're all in just one little area of that inhabited area. Most of the Dumis today speak Nepali language. Even most of the, especially the younger shamans, are switching into Nepali language, which, of course, poses some other difficulties or some other things to think about when recording all these oral traditions. And the core of most rituals among the Dumi is about keeping up a relation with their ancestors. And the ancestors and the link with the ancestors is basically it's kept through the oven, the chula, inside the house. This is a scene from one ritual which is done after harvest, where the people actually speak to the ancestors through the oven of the house. And the individual and the collective well-being in Dumi society is very strongly dependent on the goodwill of these ancestors, and it is the ritual performance that safeguards these good relations through the recitations of the ritual specialists. Some of these recitations primarily consist of the recall of the origin of a lineage back to the founders of humankind. Others focus on the travel of the shaman or the dead through space and time. It is the latter, the dead, I want to focus in my examples to follow. The journey of the spirit of the deceased into the village of the ancestors as it is conducted as part of the death ritual. Many of the recitations done during rituals can also be done through knowledgeable elders that recite the texts addressed towards the ancestors. Such rituals do not include the entering of the reciting person into trance. A trance-like state is only necessary if the rituals are of an ill-natured kind, like an unnatural death case, or a soul that has been abducted by roaming spirits, to name only two examples. Such rituals, often termed as chinta, need a proper shaman to conduct them, as they treat situations that require the ritual specialist to actually go onto a spiritual travel himself, through trance if necessary, and to fight against the cause of the disease in a transcendent sphere, which is different to the sphere the people sitting around him are actually sitting inside at the moment. Whereas in death rituals, it is not the shaman traveling, it is the dead soul traveling. So that's the main difference between it's on one side the shaman, the other side the soul of the deceased. For the travel during a chinta, the shaman needs a special armament because the evil spirits he meets on the way will fight him, and the soul will only be released after hard bargaining and in most cases after a blood offer, an example we also heard in other examples before. In his journey, the shaman will visit places which also exist in real topography, and there he will meet beings of mythological importance. These beings might include mythological animals or the cultural hero Kakchilipu and his sisters Toma and Kema that stand at the beginning of the mythological migration history of the Dumi. The journey will eventually also lead the ritual specialist to places outside material topography, to the sky god and founder of mankind, Paruhang, for example. There are also rituals in which the shaman travels as bodily person. As an example, we can take the yearly rituals held at important water sources, and Anne was talking about some of these rituals which had been forbidden by the Maoists. It was the same situation in my area, even though the Maoists said it is about the alcohol that is consumed during the rituals, which wasn't in their way of how they wanted to see a culture being basically performed. But in my case, it was quite easy to solve, and I was talking to some of the Maoist leaders, and they actually, at least while I was there, they were reallowing these rituals for the purpose of documenting them, because you could really talk with them and explain them the necessity of these rituals. And these rituals, when many of the shamans meet and dance, it's often rituals where the shamans actually have to dance from the place where they're living up to the place where the actual ritual is performed. And on the way, on this travel route, they stop at certain points. They stop at water sources. They stop at major crossings, at stones, at trees, which are supposed to include spirits, and they dance there. So the first part of these rituals is already a travel in an actual landscape. Though it is, in this case, it's not only the soul journeys, but also material journeys in ritual, which determine the ritual topography and by it draw somehow a mythological map of the territory. And it is these recitations, especially also done during death rituals, that these close links between ritual, mythology, and topography become very obvious. The journey of the soul of the dead, which gets recited by a ritual specialist during the funeral, more or less encircles the actual settling area of the Dumi, with special respect to the area the deceased used to live in. Each clan has its own village of the dead within the settling area. The travel routes the spirits of the deceased takes overlaps with the actual migration route of the clan. Which rituals are of special interest in the analysis of the relations between ritual, myth, and topography? It is of course those in which travels in the landscape are recited and performed specifically. Among them, death rituals and so-called chintas figure most prominently. So what do I mean when talking about landscape in my example? Among the Dumi, topographical orientation is rooted in rivers and mountains, the two elements determining the landscape of Dumi settling area in general. The ritual journeys and the mythological geography are, as mentioned before, to a great extent linked to material topography. A Dumi will usually know the material landscape described in the death ritual of his or her own clan, and maybe some of the points of other clans. Nearby stations in the soul travel of a shaman in a chinta will be known to everybody, or points of great importance, like villages, big stones which represent certain gods and goddesses, or historical spots commemorating scenes from Dumi history or mythology. Apart from obvious landmarks which coincide in material and ritual landscape, there are many associations of the natural habitat, the fauna and flora, which link a certain recited passage to a specific material place. This form of mental mapping of ritual and mythological landscape linked to material landscape forms a great part of the identity of the Dumi. The overlapping of the material map, which can be walked on, and the mental map, which can be apprehended in ritual and myth, strengthens the bond between the people and their land. How to record these things? Having such a diversity of different topics to cover, the methodology used to gather the data needs also to be diversified in a way. It has to go beyond the pure documentation and the analysis of the recitations. The multi-layered implications suggested by the texts have to be included in the process. The documentation of rituals, in my case, is done in several steps. First, again, by recording audiovisual recordings, by filming the scene with the help of the local people. And then, secondly, by taking, and this is probably something that the new technology allows us, taking a few hours later or a day later, taking the actual film of the recitation, sit with the shamans, have a look at the film, and ask the performer to comment on what he was doing and to maybe, if it wasn't understandable because of drums or because of whatever chickens picking on the microphone, to re-recite the whole passage to be able to actually transfer it onto paper. Which is a long and tedious process, but it's certainly a process that has been that has become much, much easier through the technology. We can carry the battery, which lasts long enough to really sit with the people and watch the things. And maybe this is also something that's in between the in vitro and the direct recording Martin was talking about this morning, something that links these two together. Then, because I'm interested in the toponyms and the kind of implications on topography we can find in these rituals, I'm trying to find out about references made to actual places in the land, going through the landscapes together with the shamans and visiting the places they are chanting about. So somehow the whole working on these materials includes a lot of walking through the landscapes and a lot of discussions on points that might be of interest in the analysis of these rituals. Then, of course, again, we have technical possibilities. What I've been doing in the last years, that we have been kind of GPS tracking the travel routes of the shamans, and it's something that works, because then, in the end, you can actually put the things on a proper topographical map. And if you put these two maps, kind of the mental map and the topographical map together, you can see how these worlds and how the transcendent and the real world actually interrelate. Then what I'm trying and what I'm just building up now is a database, not only of toponyms, but also of photographs which portray these places mentioned in the recitations. So it's again basically another level of translating a text. It's not by translating it into English language, but it's by picturing it in a photograph, which probably might, in some cases, explain more about the content than anything else. And with this topic, we come to a big theme in Dumi culture, and the whole political aspect comes in, because we've heard about the breakup of Nepal and kind of all these ethnic groups asking for their own identities, which they need to support their claim for an independent state in Nepal. And suddenly, while we started to walk around these places with the shamans, people realized, okay, these places seem to have there's people coming to watch these places, and they started to kind of give a stronger importance to these places. And suddenly last year I went there and they started to show me places which they rediscovered, which include parts of their mythology. This, for example, underneath this tree, the grave of Kapchilipu, the mythological hero, supposed to be. And it was the first time we visited that place, and only two elderly men in the village knew well it should be there. But together with Chatubakta Rai, the president of the Dumi Kirat Yauka, the main kind of representative body of the Rai people, we went there, and they had the idea to kind of develop these places into cultural heritage places to support their claim for their own identity. So the whole documentation process also triggers off new responses to the landscape and triggers off new ways of reading the landscape. And this place is actually outside the actual Dumi settling area, but of course the whole discourse of a common Rai identity, it's about a common Rai identity and not a common identity for the small local groups. And then, of course, what we also have, we do have local sources and we do have local written sources. And this is, in many of the rituals, the recitations actually trace back genealogies back to Paruhang, the founder of of or the, like basically the first being in the whole genealogy. So in many of the recitations, all the people following up all the maybe 20 or 30 last generations have to be mentioned. So if you're talking to the ancestor, you have to address them by their names. And because this at times gets complicated, especially when the younger ones are not so willing to remember these names anymore, people already started to write them down. And this was a situation when an old man, he had the sheet, he couldn't read it, but he gave it to the teacher of the village, and the teacher was shouting the names to the shaman, who was nearly deaf, and the shaman again was shouting the name into the fire, and they had to shout it 3 or 4 times each, because he was always understanding a different word than the one he was supposed to call the ancestor. So this is already something that also has to be included, of course, in this whole kind of looking at these texts. Then, in the mapping side, I've started to prepare maps for the death ritual chants, and every clan has a different chant to guide their ancestors to the village of the ancestors. And if we look, this is a map of the main Dumi area, and all these grey places are the village of the ancestors of certain clans. So if somebody dies in one of these areas, there has to be a way the spirit is guided into that village. And I have one example here what these villages might look like. They're sometimes even overlapping real villages. In that case, it's not villages where Dumi live, but Chitri or other people. Sometimes they're in rocks, like in this case. Sometimes they're just in a forest without any like visible objects which might mark this place in a special way. This is one of the places. And I want to show you some examples how such a guidance looks like in a recitation. This is now a very free translation, just to give you an idea how these souls are actually guided through the landscape and how real this travel actually feels. And if you have a short look, maybe I can just pick out some of the points. It is very much clan-related, so in the first line it's always addressing the person of a certain clan that has to go to the village of the ancestors. And then they explain to the spirit or this kind of soul substance which is guided into the village of the dead that it has died. And this is one of the main topics in the whole death ritual, that this spirit has to realize that it's actually dead, and that this transfer into the ancestral world is actually conducted properly. But then again, there is all these mentionings that body and spirit go to the ancestral water source, the water source of Muktalo, near Jaranka village. So this is the things I'm trying to map. How does the travel of these groups actually go? And then they actually give a very bodily-like appearance, like in the words, to that spirit. So the spirit is asked to rest, to take a rest, to have something to eat, to drink and wash themselves at the riverside, and to think about again about the new state of being on the way to their ancestors, and only then the spirit travels on. And this whole process of transferring the soul into the ancestral world is, it goes throughout the whole ritual. And then at the end, and this is something what Mark Opitz yesterday described as the separatio, really cutting apart the ancestral world from the world of the living, this is always repeated, and the people standing around the death body while saying that, they actually lift up their kukris in the air and say, cut, now you're away, and they really scare away the spirit to just to be sure it's not roaming around later on. And there is one scene, I mean the whole death ritual is about preparations for the travel, and this is a death ritual I was able to witness last year, and the body is prepared with bird feathers which are stuck underneath his arms, so while he's traveling he has to cross obstacles at times. So if these obstacles are too high or his legs are not strong enough, these feathers can make him fly over it. Or there's a tail of a pig laid into his hand, a pig that was offered during another stage of the ritual. So in case he has to swim across water and he can't swim, he can cling on the tail of the pig which is able to swim. So there's a lot of symbolism and all the symbolism in the death ritual, many of the symbolisms are really to prepare the spirit to have a good travel into the ancestral village. And if you map such a travel of one clan, which I did here, you see how, of course, the beginning of the travel is always very individual, because it starts in the place where the person has actually lived, and then only after going from the house to the courtyard, and from the courtyard to maybe the nearest water source, then it kind of joins the common route which all ancestors of this certain clan take on their way to the village of the ancestors. And this is now a very special example, because as you see, the travel starts in the midst of Dumi area, and then it leaves the actual Dumi area and goes to a place which is further north, which doesn't belong to the actual core settling area of the group. And this is something I found out in the death ritual. And I was questioning myself what is behind that the village of the ancestors is outside the actual Dumi area. And I was researching deeper in that matter, and I actually found that this is the only clan among the Dumi which isn't originally Dumi, which came from a neighboring group, the Sangpang Rai, which lives outside, but which was, over the years, integrated and accepted as being Dumi. So we can actually see how such migration stories, or such stories of groups intermarrying and fusing after time, actually can be retraced in these ritual recitations, and through mapping them can be made visible. Then, on another stage in the same ritual, the soul, when it is integrated, it is called back into the shrine, the ancestral shrine of the house. Then the whole travel goes backward and joins the house again. So it is really the topography, and it's in the end, it's studying topography and these notions of identity rooted and these notions of identity rooted in it, that can be explored by one of the oldest and probably finest methodologies anthropology has to offer, by walking through the landscape and really traveling through the recited landscape. And one very important question, which maybe we can already go towards the discussion now, is now that we really, through these recitations, we learn that identity among the Dumi is something very local. Because, I mean, it's not only these places that I refer to, it's also, like I said before, it's the flora and fauna, and it's the flora and fauna of exactly that area. If you travel one day north, or if you travel one day south, there will be different plants, there will be different animals. And the whole system, or the whole descriptions in the songs don't work anymore for this different landscape. So if identity and if religion is so strongly linked to a certain place in topography, this of course poses a lot of difficulties when activists try to move Dumi identity and try to move Dumi religion outside of that area. And this is what's happening today in Dharan or in Kathmandu. More Dumis live in Dharan and Kathmandu, like in the Dumi settling area, I guess, by now. So they do their dances, they do their rituals, but still, for example, if somebody dies, he's guided back to that place. And this kind of, there's a lot of kind of reinvention and bending of these texts going on now to fit them into a kind of a framework which fits more the implications of the new settlement areas of the Dumi. So maybe this is also something to pose to the other presenters. How is it done there if a diaspora wants to live on in their ethnic identity? How can it be transferred if ethnic identity is such a localized version? So I want to keep it at that and maybe open up the discussion and for questions. Thank you.